Afternoon, you're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is March 26th, 85th day of the year. 280 days remain till the year's over with. Holidays and observances, and remember, you all asked for this. National Science Appreciation Day, Live Long and Prosper Day, Make Up Your Own Holiday Day, Purple Day, National Spinach Day, Good Hair Day, National Nougat Day, Tick Bite Prevention Week, National Physicians Week, Still in Ramadan, March Madness, National Cleaning Week, Famous People Born on This Date, Jonathan Groff, Diana Ross, Larry Page, Nancy Pelosi, Bobby. And March is also the Great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, Veggie Month, National Sauce Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Developmental Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Nutrition Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Umbrella Month, National Kidney Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Credit Education Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, Rising Star Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. A little history segment. I heard somebody make a comment that I thought was quite appropriate. I've been asked why I do this segment. And if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. And that's quite true. Now, in 590 A.D., Emperor Maurice proclaims his son Theodosius co-emperor of the Byzantine Empire. It's always nice to give your kids a job. 624, the first Eid al-Fitr celebration. 1021 A.D., the death of the Fatimid Caliph al-Hakim b. Amr Allah. Kept secret for 6 weeks, is finally announced along with the succession of his son, Al-Zahir Idli Izaz Din Allah. 1027, Pope John the 19th crowns Conrad II, Holy Roman Emperor. You know, by that point in history, it wasn't an empire, it wasn't holy, and it suddenly wasn't Roman. 1169, Saladin becomes the Emir of Egypt. 1344, the siege of Algeciras, one of the first European military engagements where gunpowder was used, comes to an end. 1351, combat of the Trinity. 30 Breton knights call out and defeat 30 English knights. 1484, William Caxton prints his translation of Aesop's Fables. 1552, Guru Amar Das becomes the third Sikh Guru. 1636, Utrecht University is founded in the Netherlands. 1640, the Royal Academy of Turku, the first university of Finland, is founded in the city of Turku by Queen Christina of Sweden at the proposal of Count Perbrahe. 1651, silver-loaded Spanish ship San Jose is pushed south by strong winds, subsequently wrecks in the coast of southern Chile, and its surviving crew is killed by indigenous Kunkos. 1697, Safavid government troops take control of Basra. 1700, William Dampier is the first European to circumnavigate New Britain, discovering it's an island, which he names Nova Britannia rather than part of New Guinea. 1812, an earthquake devastates Caracas, Venezuela. Also on this date in 1812, a political cartoon in the Boston Gazette coins the term gerrymander to describe oddly shaped electoral districts designed to help certain incumbents win elections. 1830, the Book of Mormon is published in Palmyra, New York. 1839, the first Henley Royal Regatta is held. This date in 1871, the elections of Commune Council of the Paris Commune are held. 1885, the Métis people of the District of Saskatchewan under Louis Riel began the Northwest Rebellion against Canada. 1896, an explosion at the Brunner Mine near Greymouth, New Zealand, killed 65 coal miners in the country's worst industrial accident. 1913, the First Balkan War. Bulgarian forces capture Adrianople. 1915, the Vancouver Millionaires win the 1915 Stanley Cup Finals. That was the first championship played between the Pacific Coast Hockey Association and the National Hockey Association. 1917, World War I, First Battle of Gaza. British troops are halted after 17,000 Turks block their advance. 1922, German Social Democratic Party is founded in Poland. 1931, Swiss Air is founded as the National Airline of Switzerland. 1931, the Ho Chi Minh Communist Youth Union is founded in Vietnam. 1934, the United Kingdom driving test is introduced. 1939, the Spanish Civil War. Nationalists begin their final offensive of the war. 1942, World War II, the first female prisoners arrive at Auschwitz concentration camp in German-occupied Poland. 1945, World War II, the Battle of Iwo Jima ends as the islands officially secured by American forces. 1954, nuclear weapons testing. The Romeo shot of Operation Castle is detonated at the Bikini Atoll. It's the yield was 11 megatons. 1955, Pan Am Flight 845-26 ditches in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Oregon. Four people are killed. 1958, U.S. Army launches Explorer 3. Also in 1958, the African Regroupment Party is launched at a meeting in Paris. 1967, 10,000 people gather for one of many Central Park B-ends in New York City. 60s were a crazy time, folks. No question about that. The B-ends were held usually in Central Park in Manhattan. Wanted to protest various issues such as the involvement of the Vietnam War and racism. During the 60s, of course, we were involved in the Vietnam War. It was about as a fluke that I didn't wind up in Vietnam. The war was a controversial one because many people are against the U.S. involvement in South Vietnam. Adding to the tensions of the Americans against the war was the emergence of a generation of people who were part of the counterculture and believed they should be able to do anything possible to go against the establishment. And the counterculture generation decided that Central Park would be the perfect place for their demonstrations. They had sleep-ins and lie-ins and be-ins and all kinds of ins. 1965, citizens of New York experienced their first blow against their freedom of speech as Commissioner Newbold Morris refused to give them a permit that they need in order to use a section of the park for anti-war speeches. Opponents of the ban called it a form of discrimination. 1967, Parks Commissioner August Heckscher II said Central Park would no longer be allowed to serve as a venue for mass demonstrations because they were disruptive and caused damages to the park that were very costly to the city to repair. Well, he was met with great opposition by protesters who held up unauthorized banners and burned draft cards in the park. He decided to set up designated areas just for these types of demonstrations, such as Randall's Island. And as part of the compromise made by the New York Civil Liberties Union, a separate area of Central Park was set up for big demonstrations. And it was well used, let me tell you. 1970, South Vietnam President Nguyen Van Thieu implements a land reform program to solve the problem of land tenancy. 1971, East Pakistan declared its independence from Pakistan to form Bangladesh, and the Bangladesh Liberation War begins. 1975, the Biological Weapons Convention comes into force. 1979, Anwar Sadat, Menachem Begin, and Jimmy Carter, the Peanut Man, signed the Egypt-Israeli Peace Treaty in Washington, D.C. Also in 79, an Intruflugulution 218 crashes in the Quatro de Ferro Airport during a rejected takeoff. 10 people are killed. 1981, Social Democratic Party in the UK is founded as a party, officially. 1982, a groundbreaking ceremony of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is held in Washington, D.C. 1991, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay signed the Treaty of Ascension, establishing a Mercosur, the South Common Market. 1997, 39 bodies are found in the Heaven Gate mass suicide. 1998, during the Algerian Civil War, the Queen Bouzoucha massacre sees 52 people, mostly infants, killed with axes and knives. The took place about 150 miles south of Algiers during the Civil War. 47 people, including 27 children under the age of 16, were killed at Oued Boulacha in the municipality of Bouri Labdab by about 15 men carrying axes and knives who also kidnapped three young women. That same day, another 11 people were killed on the other side of the country at the Yub. I don't know what they were trying to prove, but I tend to doubt they proved anything. And the fact they wanted to kill somebody. 2005, about 200 to 300,000 Taiwanese demonstrate in Taipei in opposition to the anti-secession law of China. 2010, the South Korean Navy corvette, the Seonan, is torpedoed, killing 46 sailors. After an international investigation, the president of the United Nations Security Council blames North Korea. 2017, Russia-wide anti-corruption protest in 99 cities. The Levada Center survey showed that 38% of the surveyed Russians support protest and 67% held Putin personally responsible for high-level corruption. And speaking about China for a moment, the attack on the Moscow Concert Hall has really had a devastating effect on Russian society. It's considered the nation's worst terrorist attack in decades. And nearly a dozen people have been detained in connection with the attack. It's all armed assailants storm a popular concert venue complex on the outskirts of the capital. More than 130 people, at last count, were killed. The attack was armed with guns and incendiary devices, opened fire at random at the Crocus City Complex, home to both a popular music hall and shopping center. It happened Friday night. Crowds are still filing in, but the auditorium is already packed with people ahead of a concert by the band Picnic. About 6,500 tickets had reportedly been sold for the show. But instead of the night dancing away to rock music, it turned into utter chaos. Panicked eyewitnesses captured on video the exact moment gunmen dressed in camouflage fatigues and carrying automatic weapons started shooting indiscriminately. The footage shows concert goers screaming and ducking for cover behind cushioned seats. Others huddled together as shots echoed through the hall. During the rampage, one group sheltered next to a large wall of windows outside the concert venue. They were forced to break them to escape the gunfire. Unnamed male witness who saw the attack said the gunman entered the concert hall and just started shooting. Said, "I was sitting in the hall upstairs where the balconies were. We heard the gunshots, but we didn't understand what was happening." He said the attackers threw Molotov cocktails, setting everything on fire. The band's manager told state media the performers were unharmed. A SWAT team was called into the area, and 170 ambulance teams and doctors assisted the victims. The fires were still burning at Crocus City on the Saturday, and the roof of the venue hall collapsed. Nearly 500 personnel were working to dismantle rubble at the scene to see if there's any additional bodies underneath. At least 133 people are known to have been killed in the complex, according to the latest update from Russia's investigative committee on Saturday. Authorities say that number is going to probably keep rising as emergency responders work through the scene. Additionally, more than 100 others were injured in the incident, many of them in serious condition, including two children. Governor of Moscow region, Andrei Voroboyev, said Saturday the victims of the terror attack were to get financial compensation from the region and city governments. Relatives of those who were killed would receive 3 million rubles, that's about $32,000, while those injured in the hospital get 1 million rubles, that's about $10,000. He also said children registered in the Moscow region whose father and mother died in the tragedy would also get monthly payments. And in addition, it'd compensate everybody for burial expenses and resolve all the legal issues. Well, of course, the big question is who was behind this? And ISIS has claimed responsibility for the assault in a statement published by the ISIS-affiliated Amaq news agency on Telegram on Friday. Next day, the terror group published an image through Amaq purporting to show the four men who had attacked the complex. Now, none of the men were identifiable in the image. They were all wearing balaclavas, and the rest of their faces are blurred. ISIS described the attack as the fiercest in years, according to a translation of the message sent by the SITE intelligence group that monitors terror groups' propaganda. According to ISIS, the attack comes within the normal context of the raging war between the Islamic State and countries fighting Islam. You know, the U.S. had previously warned Moscow ISIS militants were determined to target Russia in the days before the assailants stormed the concert hall. Earlier this month, the U.S. Embassy in Russia had said it was monitoring reports that extremists have immediate plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, which would include concerts, and it warned U.S. citizens to avoid these places. Well, U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson said the U.S. government had shared this information with Russian authorities in accordance with its longstanding duty to warn policy. But in a speech on Tuesday, Putin blasted our warnings as provocative, saying these actions resemble outright blackmail and the intention to intimidate and destabilize our society. I think Putin is the type of person that listened to Don Quixote and didn't get the joke. Well, I just wanted to give you an update on the attack. Well, we've been talking about unsolved murders, and there's a lot of them. Some better known than others. We're going to talk about the Interkefek murders. It took place in 1922. And it's been said by investigators a few unsolved murders contain so many secrets and raise so many disturbing questions as this particular story encompasses incest, jealousy, and unbelievable violence. Now, Interkefek was the name of a small, isolated farmstead situated in the hills and forests between the towns of Ingolstadt and Schrobenhausen in Bavaria in Germany. Home of Andreas Gruber, 63, his wife, Kazilla, 72, their widowed daughter, Victoria Gabriel, 35, her children, Kazilla, 7, and Joseph, 2, and a maid, Maria Baumgartner, 44. Well, on the night of March 31st, 1922, somebody systematically slaughtered every member of the family one by one and piled their bodies up in the barn. Andreas Gruber wasn't a popular man in the community. He was thought to be aggressive and greedy, and people in the nearby village generally avoided him if they could. Victoria was the only child of Andreas and Gazilia to have survived to adulthood. Locals speculated the other children had perished because they were not looked after properly and were treated very cruelly by their parents. Small children had to stay in the cellar for days. When he passed by, he could hear the children crying, according to one neighbor. Even more damaging to Andreas' reputation was the public knowledge he was having an incestuous relationship with Victoria, whose husband, Carl Gabriel, had died in France in 1914 during World War I. A year after his death, Andreas and Victoria were convicted of incest between the years of 1907 and 1910. Victoria was sentenced to 1 month, and Andreas got 1 year in prison. It's also rumored that Andreas was the real father of little Joseph and not the village mayor, Lorenz Schinnenbauer, with whom Victoria had also been having an intimate relationship. At the same time, she became pregnant. Now, Lorenz wanted to marry Victoria, but was stopped by Andreas, who angrily chased him away from the farm with a sickle. Krasinz Reiger, the Gruber's maid before the ill-fated Maria Baumgartner, told police she'd overheard Andreas tell Victoria that she didn't need to marry because as long as he lives, he's there for this. The maid claimed that by this, Andreas was alluding to the fact that he was there to sexually satisfy his daughter, so she didn't need a husband. In the days leading up to the murders, Andreas told neighbors about some odd occurrences that had been unfolding on the farm. Munich newspaper was discovered in the kitchen, on the kitchen windowsill, which the family found peculiar because it wasn't a local newspaper. When Andreas questioned the postman, Joseph Mayer, about it, he denied he'd delivered the newspaper to anybody in the area. When Andreas looked out at the snow-covered farmland, he noticed footprints leading from the edge of the forest to the farm and none leading back. So it would appear there was a trespasser. Somebody mayhap had been watching the family. Krasinz Reiger thought so. Working on the farm, she was so convinced somebody or something was lurking in the shadows of the forest that just months before the murder, she packed her bags and left, never to return. About that same time, the house keys disappeared from Andreas's desk and somebody attempted to break into the engine yard. Well, Andreas also voiced concerns that he had livestock missing and that somebody was creeping around in his attic. Over the course of several nights, he heard strange noises coming from the attic, but when he went to investigate, he didn't find anything. His neighbors would go to the police, and Andreas refused, saying, "I know how to defend myself." Well, while these incidents were the cause for concern, nobody could have expected what happened next. From April 1st, all the members of the Gruber family seemed to vanish. Gazilla didn't appear at school that day. Saturday, and the family didn't attend church on Sunday. The absence of Victoria, who sang in the choir, was particularly noticed. Well, on Tuesday, three neighbors decided they needed to investigate. Discovering all the doors were locked, they broke into the barn adjoining the farmhouse. Daylight penetrated the murky barn and illuminated a ghastly sight. They found the bludgeoned bodies of Andreas, his wife Gazilla, Victoria, and her daughter Zazilla piled up among the hay. Now, from the barn, the neighbors were able to enter the farmhouse where they found the bodies of the new maid, Maria, and little Joseph. Each of the victims had suffered blows to the head that had proved to be fatal. Well, the police concluded that the first four victims had been lured one by one to the barn and murdered before they could even cry out. Killers stacked their bodies one on top of the other and partially covered them with hay and an old door that had been dumped in the barn. Then he went into the farmhouse where he killed Joseph, who was sleeping on his cot, and then Maria. He covered their bodies with clothing and sheets. Well, each of the victims, it turned out, had been bludgeoned with a mattock. That's a pickaxe-like farming tool on the face and head. The elder Gazilla, that's the mother, also showed signs of strangulation. And while the majority died a quick, although vicious, death, the younger Gazilla took several hours to die. Pathologists discovered tufts of her hair tangled in her feathers and in her fingers. She'd apparently pulled some of it out as she lay dying. Well, the pathologist estimated the murders took place at about 9:30 in the evening on March 31st. Now, apparently, the killer didn't immediately flee the scene. He remained at the farm for several days, feeding and milking the livestock and helping himself to bread and ham from the pantry. Neighbors later claimed they had seen smoke coming from the farmhouse chimney. Family dog had been tied up in the barn, but it wasn't harmed. Schrobenhausen police were called in to assist the investigation, but after realizing they were in over their heads, the more experienced Munich police force came in and took over the case. The initial theory was that the killer was a vagrant, motivated by the family's considerable wealth. But a search at the farm indicated that gold coins and jewelry hidden in the house had not been touched, and no belongings or livestock were missing. So that left out robbery as a motive. When the police questioned local residents, the name Joseph Bartle came to their attention. He was a serial robber who had once escaped a mental institution. In 1919, he robbed the Alder family in the small village of Ebenhausen, about 13 miles from Hinterkaifeck. Many speculated only a madman like Joseph would have remained at the crime scene, living alongside the bloody bodies of his victims for so many days. However, other than the most tenuous circumstantial evidence, nothing tied him to the crime. Mendler Renz Schittenbauer, who once wanted to marry Victoria and if possibly Father Joseph, was a prime suspect throughout the investigation. He was one of the three neighbors who discovered the bodies, and he lived the closest to the Hinterkaifeck farm. And he had clashed violently with Andreas over his relationship with Victoria, even reported him to the authorities for their incestuous relationship. And according to other neighbors on the scene, Schlittenbauer had also said to have been remarkably unfazed when the Gruber's bodies were discovered, despite the gruesome nature of what they found. His outwardly calm behavior could well have been attributed to shock. Lorenz Schlittenbauer was interrogated at the crime scene on April 5th, 1922. Time of the murders, he claimed he was a happily married man with no motive for killing the entire Gruber family. Nevertheless, even today, he still remains a favored suspect among the townfolk of Ingolstadt. Schlittenbauer's family still live in the town and has had to endure speculation he was the killer, even though, as his son Adlios pointed out, there's never been an indictment. One of the more inventive theories about the case concerned Victoria's ex-husband, Carl Gabriel, who supposedly died in the trenches in 1914. Turns out his body was never actually retrieved, leading the Schlobenhausen chief of police, Ludwig Mexel, to suggest that maybe he hadn't died at all. If he'd survived the war, he could have traveled to Hinterkaifeck and committed the murders, maybe to revenge for his wife's incestuous affair with her father. However, on December 12, 1923, Carl Gabriel's death was officially confirmed by the Central Prosecution Office for War Losses and War Graves, and he was ruled out as a suspect. After all, according to the police chief, it's hard to commit murder when you're dead yourself. That was not impossible. Another surprising suspect was the cruel and controlling head of the family, Andreas Gruber himself. According to author Ada Jacob Koppel, in an article in the Munich newspaper, Benzeitung, the mattock used to kill the victims was handmade by Gruber himself and would have been difficult for an untrained person to wield with such deadly efficiency. Of course, this theory fails to explain how Andreas could have been inflicted with such fatal injuries on himself. It's awful hard to beat yourself in the head with a mattock until you die. 1941, an elderly neighbor, Crescentia Meyer, made a deathbed confession to her priest, Anton Huber. She stated her brother, Adolf and Anton Gump, were responsible for the Hinterkaifeck murders. She said her oldest brother, Adolf, had been in an intimate relationship with Victoria and been infuriated when he became aware of Victoria and Andreas Gruber's incestuous relationship. You have to ask yourself, who didn't Victoria have intimate relationships with? According to Crescentia Meyer, Adolf and Anton had killed Victoria and Andreas Gruber and then dispatched everyone else living at the farm to ensure there would be no witnesses. But it wasn't until 1952 that the police decided to investigate the brothers' possible guilt. By this time, Adolf had been dead for 8 years, and Anton was an elderly pensioner who categorically denied any involvement in the murders. He was arrested, but after 3 weeks in custody, released without a charge. With a combination of the unexplained footprints in the snow leading from the forest to the farm and the mysterious sounds coming from the attic, you get a somewhat frightening picture of a sadistic intruder hiding in the house and waiting for his moment to strike. This picture continues to fascinate professional and amateur sleuths decades after the slaying took place. But the sheer lack of evidence, incomplete case records, and the death of potential witnesses and suspects means that it's doubtful the mystery of the Intricate murders to ever be solved. The most recent investigation into the case took place in 1986, and over the years, more than 100 suspects have been questioned. Unfortunately, during World War II, a significant number of the police files were destroyed. In addition, a bust of all six of the victims' heads that was sent to the Pathology Institute of the University of Munich for analysis were lost because of the war. While the heads were in Munich, they were sent to a clairvoyant who claimed that two people had committed the murders. 1 year after the murders of Hinterkaifeck, a court order was given for the farmhouse and outbuildings to be demolished. A small marble monument near the original site, along with six graves for the family and their maid, is all that now remains to mark the site where all this took place all those years ago. But if somebody's living in the attic, the question becomes, why were they taking the time to spy on the family they're going to kill? Well, they say you cannot commit the perfect crime. Well, we're going to talk about the Julia Wallace murder of 1931, which was considered a history-making case of a perfect crime. It was also considered to be an impossible murder. Prosecuting counsel, Edward Hermody, KC, made the comment, few more brutal murders can ever have been committed. It was an elderly, lonely woman literally hacked to death for no reason at all. See, when you're investigating murders, you look for connections. And a serial killer is the hardest one to catch because there is no connection. You know, the murder of Julia Wallace, who was bludgeoned to death in the parlor of her home in Liverpool, England, January 20th, 1931, is widely regarded as one of the most baffling of all unsolved crimes. It's a classic locked room murder mystery. It's fascinated crime writers such as Raymond Chandler and Dorothy Sayers, inspired the P.D. James novel, The Skull Beneath the Skin, and also been the subject of a television drama, investigative documentaries, and numerous true crime books and articles in the press. Case also made British legal history. It's the first time a murder conviction was overturned on appeal following a review of the evidence. Prior to that, you get convicted, you're going to die. Well, William Herbert Wallace and his wife Julia lived in a small three-bedroom home. It was called a row house on Wolverton Street in the poor district of Anfield, Liverpool. Been married for 17 years. William had traveled widely as a young man, visiting both India and China, and he was forced to come home because of illness and met Julia a couple years after his return to Britain. He was an insurance agent with a Prudential Assurance Company, while Julia was an amateur painter and pianist. In fact, both Julia and William were musically gifted, with William being a very adept violin player. Couple would often play and sing duets together. And Julia was exceptionally intelligent, having studied philosophy and dabbled in chemistry. She claimed to be younger than she was. She was actually 17 years older than her 52-year-old husband. According to William, their marriage was harmonious. Friends and neighbors would testify that there was nothing to indicate otherwise. He also said it was my wife's rigid rule not to admit strangers to the house when she was alone. Well, on the evening of Monday, January 19, 1931, 52-year-old William Wallace arrived at the Liverpool Central Chess Club at the City Cafe on North John Street. The club met every Monday and Thursday, but William wasn't a regular member. In fact, he hadn't visited the club for some time. He was known as an enthusiastic player other than a good one and only qualified for the second-class team. Club captain Samuel Beatty had taken a telephone call for Wallace and had a message for him. Caller identified himself as R.M. Qualtrough and requested Wallace should come to 25 Menlo Garden East the following evening at 7:30 to discuss an insurance deal. Caller said, "I want to talk to him particularly." Went on to add he couldn't call back because it was his daughter's 21st birthday and he was particularly busy. William took Beatty's note and put it in his pocket, told Beatty he didn't know anybody by the name of R.M. Qualtrough, but he had visited Amari anyway. Times were tough in Depression-era Britain, and Wallace foresaw the possibility he might make some much-needed money. Next evening, Wallace finished his day's work at the Prudential Assurance Company and went home where Julia had dinner waiting. When he finished eating, Wallace told her he had a meeting with a man who would hopefully bring him more insurance business. As he put on his coat, he added he would be home as soon as possible. Now, he set off for 25 Menlo Garden East. He hadn't heard of the address before, but he knew the general area. He boarded a number 26 train at Belmont Road, then a number 4 train at Smithdown Road, and the 5A at Penny Lane Junction, which set off for Menlo Gardens at 7:15. During the journey, he chatted with the conductor and the ticket inspector, mentioning he was going to Menlo East on business. Well, when he got off at Menlo Gardens West, he spoke to a woman coming out of her house and asked for directions to Menlo Garden East, and the woman really wasn't sure. So he continued up Menlo Garden West and asked directions from a man named Sidney Hubert. He told Wallace there was no such street, at least to his knowledge. So he knocked at 25 Menlo Gardens West, home of Richard and Katie Mather, and asked if Mr. Qualtrough lived there. And they said he didn't, and Wallace headed toward Menlo Garden North, where he saw a man at a train stop. Asked him for directions, but the man was from out of town and couldn't help him. Well, realizing he was now at the top of Green Lane, where a friend of his, Joseph Crewe, lived, he knocked at his door. Getting no answer, Crewe and his wife had gone to the cinema. Wallace walked down Green Lane, where he saw a policeman, P.C. James Edward Sergeant, and asked him if he knew where Menlo Garden East was, if he knew Mr. Qualtrough. Apparently, the police was a receptive listener. Wallace relayed the entire story regarding the phone call. And Wallace also verified the time with the PC that it was 7:45. Well, before heading home, Wallace went to the post office and asked once again for directions to Menlo East. Clerk wasn't sure and suggested Wallace go to the news agents across the street. Shop assistant Nasty Collins and manageress Lily Pinches listened to Wallace's story and finally convinced him that Menlo Gardens East did not exist. Well, his patience exhausted, he made his way back home, pondering who R.M. Qualtrough might be and why he had seen fit to leave him such a non-existent address on a cold, dark winter's evening. Wallace later claimed he didn't speak to anybody on the way home, but a near neighbor named Lily Hall claimed she spotted a distinctive figure of Wallace in conversation with a short, stocky man. Well, Wallace arrived home at 8:45 p.m. only to discover that he couldn't get unable to open either his front door or his back door. Both doors appeared to be locked from the inside. Next-door neighbors John and Florence Johnston saw him standing outside looking worried and asked him if he needed any help. Told him he'd been out for several hours and couldn't get into his house. However, while Mr. and Ms. Johnston was present, he walked around to the back once again, and this time the door opened. As he entered the house, a ghastly scene met his eyes. Jew was lying in front of the gas fire in the parlor. She had been bludgeoned to death with a heavy object, hit with such force her skull had been cracked open. William made the comment, "They finished her. Look at her brains." And he didn't seem to have much emotion, according to Mr. and Ms. Johnston, who was standing behind him in the doorway. Well, the police were called, and they arrived to assess the scene and make a search of the house and surrounding area. They noted there were no signs of breaking and entering, leading them to believe that Julia had admitted the killer to the house. Anfield was in the grip of a spate of burglaries by a mysterious figure known only as the Anfield Housebreaker. With speculation, he could have been the killer, but no evidence tied him to the murder, and crime didn't fit his modus operandi. Small sum of money had been stolen from a cash box in the home, but the police decided this was a ploy to give the impression the murder was the result of a robbery gone wrong. Handling of the investigation left much to be desired. While examining the crime scene, officers wandered over the house, smudged footprints and fingerprints that could have belonged to the killer. Moreover, the pathologist neglected to take the temperature of Julia's body, and therefore an accurate time of death couldn't be determined. Forensic expert named John Edward Whitley McFall based his diagnosis on the body's rigor mortis, putting the time at 8 p.m. However, rigor mortis could probably occur quite quickly in a frail elderly person such as Julia Wallace, and McFall later amended his estimate to around 6 p.m. Another expert, Dr. Hugo Pierce, put the time of death as about 6 p.m., said I'd give it 2 hours either side. Well, what was clear was the murder was frigid and brutal. Blood was splattered across the room, indicating the killer most likely would have blood on his clothing. In addition, a check of the house sinks and drains revealed that they had been used, indicating the killer had left without washing any blood off his clothing or his body. Although there was no direct evidence against him, police soon began to question whether William had killed his wife and engineered the meeting with the mysterious R.M. Qualtrough to deflect suspicion from himself. They took the fact that William had asked various people for directions as a ploy to establish an alibi for the murder. Transpired that the call from R.M. Qualtrough had come from a payphone about 400 yards from the Wallace household. Payphone was close to the stop where Wallace had caught the tram to the Liverpool Central Chess Club. However, Samuel Beatty, who had taken the phone call at the club, was adamant the voice on the other end was not that of William. Police found 5 people the last thing Qualtrough in the Liverpool area. All denied contacting the chess club. Investigators questioned why William had claimed the back door of his house was jammed, but as soon as other witnesses were present, it miraculously opened. A raincoat was found beneath Julia's body. William didn't have a spot of blood on the suit he was wearing, so police speculated he could have worn the raincoat over his naked body as he carried out the murder to shield himself from blood spatters. See, when there's a murder, immediately the first suspect is the significant other of the dead person. And quite often when the police get an idea in their head, they don't bother to investigate any further. While the police were building a case against William, the balance of evidence began to tilt in his favor. Numerous witnesses placed him on the tram at about 7.06 p.m. that evening. Others claimed to have seen Julia alive at about 6.45. One was the milk delivery boy who testified that he collected money from her between 6.30 and 6.45 p.m. This time frame implied that William would only have had about 20 minutes to murder his wife, clean himself up, and dispose of the murder weapon, which was, as I might point out, never found, hide the money was missing from the cash box, and then catch the tram. Well, on February 2nd, 1933, William Herbert Wallace was arrested and charged with his wife's murder. He stood trial at Liverpool Assizes. A few more brutal murders can never have been committed. According to the prosecuting counsel, Edward Hammerty, KC, during the trial, William seemed detached and spoken in a monotone while detailing the events connected to the murder. And his evidence failed to impress the jury. In observing the trial, crime writer F. Tennyson Jesse wrote, "The jury didn't like the man. Didn't like his manner that could have either been stoicism or callousness. He didn't understand his lack of expression. They knew it hid something. It could have been hidden sorrow or guilt, and they made their choice." F. Tennyson Jesse concluded, "People of unpleasing personality should be advised never to go into the witness box." The fact that Wallace's round metal-framed glasses resembled those of the notorious wife murderer Dr. Crippen probably didn't help his cause any at all either. All the evidence against Wallace was highly circumstantial, and no motive was ever suggested. Trial only lasted 4 days. Jury reached a verdict after deliberating for just an hour. Wallace was found guilty of his wife's murder and sentenced to die on the gallows. Well, a month later, Wallace became the first man in Britain to have a conviction for murder dismissed on the grounds it was not supported by the evidence. Well, Wallace was now a free man, but was still met with general suspicion. Moved to a bungalow on the Mersey River, where just 2 years later he died. Some said that stress and a broken heart contributed to his sudden demise. He went to his grave protesting his innocence. He was buried next to his wife. Now, if he wasn't responsible for his wife's murder, the question becomes who killed her? In 1984, true crime writer Roger Wilkes speculated in his book, Wallace, The Final Verdict, that the real murderer of Julia Wallace was Richard Gordon Pyre, a former work colleague of Wallace. Another former colleague told police that Wallace had reported Perry for wrongdoing, which led to Perry being fired. In his book, Wilkes claims Perry wanted revenge on Wallace, so he lured Wallace from his home with a phone call and committed the murder while Wallace was out searching for the non-existent address. While researching the case, Wilkes found a new witness, a retired mechanic named John Parks, who claimed that on the night of Julia Wallace's murder, he had hosed down Perry's car. And while cleaning the car's interior, he came across a bloodstained glove that Perry quickly snatched away. John Gannon's book, The Killing of Julia Wallace, named another suspect in the murder, Joseph Caleb Marsden. Gannon theorized Wallace knew he didn't have long to live and decided he didn't want to spend his final years with his hated wife. According to Gannon, Wallace hired Perry to make the bogus phone call in order to provide Wallace with a cast-iron alibi for the time of the murder. But Gannon contended neither Wallace nor Perry committed the murder, but Marsden did. Gannon asserted Marsden was about to marry into a wealthy family, but Wallace had discovered he was having a sexual relationship with Julia. This gave Wallace the opportunity to blackmail Marsden into killing his wife for him. Or he would reveal to Marsden's intended that he was carrying on an affair. During the initial investigation, though, Marsden's name cropped up as nothing more than an acquaintance of both Wallace and his wife. Since 1931, the so-called perfect murder of Julia Wallace has been investigated and reinvestigated numerous times. Nevertheless, experts still have contradicting opinions on William Herbert Wallace's guilt. And many wild rumors circulated, of course, from Wallace having an affair with Julia's sister to Julia's being overinsured and killed by William for the money. One of the most imaginative theories in the case is that William was a secret disciple of occultist Aleister Crowley who had numerous affairs behind his wife's back. Of course, there's no evidence to support any of this. Now, the murder of Julia Wallace continues to defy explanation. Raymond Chandler referred to the case as the non-parallel of all murder mysteries, the impossible murder, because Wallace couldn't have done it, neither could anybody else. And that's a good point. If she didn't open the house and there was no sign anybody broke in, how could she have been murdered? Well, we got a few more minutes. I'm going to talk about an extraordinary twist of fate. A human arm expelled by a shark becomes the first link in a bizarre chain of events involving smuggling, blackmail, and murder. This took place in 1935. The story began on a balmy spring afternoon, April 17, 1935. Bert Hobson and his son Ron were fishing from a 12-foot launch off the Maroubra Point in Coogee, Sydney, Australia. And dissatisfied with their catch up to that point, they put out set lines baited with horse mackerel before going home for the evening. Next morning, they came back to see if their set lines had caught anything worthwhile. And it was the surprise to discover a tiger shark measuring 14 feet 6 inches. Shark had been lured to the scent line to feast on a smaller shark that had become tangled in it. Hobson's managed to capture the tiger shark and sold it to the Coogee Aquarium, which happened to be run by Bert's brother, Charlie. Worldwide economic depression of the 30s had hit Sydney hard, and Charlie Hobson hoped this exciting addition would attract visitors willing to pay a bit extra to see the impressive shark fed twice a day. It's the afternoon of April 25th, Anzac Day. That's a holiday honoring World War I veterans. 8 days after the shark had been caught, a grisly discovery surfaced in the shark's tank. Now, fortunately, only a few people were present when the aquarium's prize attraction started to thrash about. Looked like it was going to try to jump out of the pool.
Moments later, a human arm, expelled by the shark, was spotted bobbing in the water. Bert Hobson used a stick to keep the gruesome find close to the side of the tank in case the huge shark tried to swallow it again. Police were immediately called, and they rushed to the scene. Well, to their surprise, that arm appeared to be in a fair state of preservation. Generally, the gastric juices of a shark would digest human flesh within days. However, the stress and shock of being captured and put on display may have slowed the shark's digestive processes. There's a piece of rope tied around the wrist of the severed arm. On the inside forearm was a tattoo of two sparring boxers. It was thought that the arm had actually been swallowed by a smaller shark that the tiger shark had eaten in turn. Generally, theories as to whose arm it was started to build. Some wondered whether the arm had been discarded by a doctor or a medical student. Others suggested, rather fancifully, that the arm could have belonged to a man who died by suicide by plunging into the ocean with his arms tied. Due to decomposition, fingerprinting was not an easy task. Medical examiners had to carefully remove skin from the fingers and then slip it over their own gloved digits in order to lift the print. Well, finally, police got their lead. A man named Edwin Smith recognized the description of the tattoo. Edwin's brother James had been missing since April 7th. That was about 3 weeks before. After telling his wife he's gone on a fishing trip with a companion. James was a 45-year-old English-born criminal, police informant, and ex-boxer who lived in the city suburb of Gladesville. Fingerprinting eventually confirmed the arm did indeed belong to James. Initially assumed that this discovery was a simple evidence of another tragic shark attack, of which there had been three in the recent months. But further examination revealed a far more disturbing scenario. It became clear the arm hadn't been bitten off by the shark. It had been severed with a knife. So this little bit, bizarre investigation suddenly turned into a murder investigation. Well, thanks to Edwin Smith's information, the police at least knew whom the arm belonged to. But now they were faced with arguably the most bizarre case they'd ever encountered. In a Wagga Wagga Express article, dated June 15, 1935, detectives freely admitted they were facing a problem seemingly devised by one of the cleverest killers in the history of Sydney's crimes. James Smith had numerous connections with the criminal underworld. While looking into his seedy acquaintances, investigators came across the name of Reginald Holmes. To many, Holmes appeared to be a respectable, wealthy businessman and family man who ran a successful boat-building business on the shores of Lavender Bay. Now, the it's interesting to note that quite often the very successful lives of people hide less than lifestyles that they would not want to get out. You know, investigators speculated Smith had been shot on the shore and his body dumped in the ocean. They hoped that finding the spent cartridge from the bullet that killed him and would identify the gun that was used, and that might lead him to the killer. Well, the beaches from Cronulla to Coogee were searched. The shark in the aquarium was killed, gutted, and examined. Both of these attempts to find any clues as to how Smith met his end were in vain. Initially, Holmes denied any involvement in the bizarre case. Shortly after police questioned him, they had gotten reports of a raving man careening around the harbor in a speedboat with blood streaming down his face. After a lengthy police pursuit, the man was captured and identified as none other than Reginald Holmes. Had a wound on his head, and he claimed that somebody had shot him. Police were skeptical of the story and concluded Holmes had inflicted a gunshot wound on himself. Either he was trying to cast himself as a victim in the case or he'd attempted to commit suicide and missed. Well, interrogation of Holmes led investigators to a convicted forger named Patrick Brady, with whom Smith had been drinking and playing cards at the Hotel Cecil in Cronulla. Police found out Brady employed several aliases, including Mr. Williams, Mr. Anderson,
and Mr. Evans and rented a cottage called Cora Joy on Tulumbi Street in Cornula. Well, when the cottage was searched, a can of kerosene mixed with blood is found in the pantry. The owner of the cottage noticed that since Brady had rented it, two rugs, two large mats, a mattress, a metal trunk, and a rope all appeared to be missing. Even more peculiar, the contents of the missing metal trunk had been placed inside a new, larger one that was found in its place. The owner also noted the cottage was been scrupulously cleaned. Impressed by this accumulation of clues, police questioned Patrick Brady, and a few days later charged him with the murder of James Smith. Well, Reginald Holmes was scheduled to appear at the coroner's inquiry, as well as the much-anticipated trial of Brady. But Holmes didn't live long enough to give his testimony. In the early hours of the very morning of the coroner's inquiry, Holmes was found shot dead in his car on Hickson Street, Dolls Point, near Sydney Harbor Bridge. This was a run-down area that law-abiding citizens tended to avoid. It was reputed to be a favorite meeting place for local smugglers. Passenger door of Holmes' Nash sedan was ajar, and the position of his wounds indicated he'd been shot three times by somebody sitting in the passenger seat. And there was no signs of a struggle, implying that Holmes had been murdered by somebody he knew well enough to allow into his car. A man fishing off Dawes Point claimed to have heard three shots at about 9 or 10 in the evening. Following Holmes' murder, his wife came forward to divulge what she knew, and in lieu of her murdered husband, became the key witness in the trial. Said that on April 8th, Patrick Brady had visited her home. His arms were cut and bloody, and carried a knapsack that she recognized belonging to Smith. Taxi driver later corroborated her story, telling investigators on the same date he had driven Brady from Cornula to Holmes' home in North Sydney. After Brady left, Holmes told his wife that Brady had murdered Smith, dismembered him, and put it in a tin trunk, put it in a boat, and tipped it overboard. Well, the majority of the detectives in the Sydney Homicide Squad believed that Brady somehow forgot about Smith's telltale tattooed arm when packing the trunk with the rest of his dismembered remains. Eventually, realizing a mistake, he disposed of it, and it was swallowed by the shark. Earlier, theorized Brady had retained Smith's arm as evidence in order to convince Holmes that the gruesome deed had been done for disposing of it in the sea. Well, the Supreme Court ruled that an arm didn't constitute a body, which was required for murder conviction, so there was no way of knowing if James Smith was deceased or not. And the judge also refused to accept Ms. Holmes' testimony regarding it as only hearsay. Generally accepted theories that when the insurance company refused to pay out after the suspicious sinking of Holmes' yacht, Smith and Holmes fell out, and Smith threatened to expose Holmes as a criminal. James Smith's wife testified she found an entry in her husband's black book that Holmes owed him 60 pounds, or maybe 65 pounds. That's $5,025 in today's currency. Says she couldn't be sure how the debt was incurred, but it's possible this was the amount Holmes owed Smith for the boat insurance scheme that went awry. In a bid to save his reputation, Holmes hired Brady to put Smith away for good, and Brady shot Smith dead in his rented cottage. Well, whoever killed James Smith, it was a million-to-one chance that their murder was ever brought to light, triggering a chain of events stranger than the plots of most fiction stories. Had the arm not been thrown up by the shark, the entire matter would have rested peacefully on the bottom of the sea. Until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.